You may have heard this by now, in fact. Monday you might have heard the report. The cancer-causing chemical benzene has been detected in the drinking water supply of a Montana town after a pipeline ruptured last Saturday, sending up to 50,000 gallons of Bakken shale crude oil into the partially frozen Yellowstone River. Imagine what a horrible scene that must be. The second Yellowstone River pipeline spill in less than 4 years. The environmental disaster has already raised alarms about how it's going to impact nearby residents, some of whom say they can smell oil in the air. That according to a statement from the Northern Plains Resource Council. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is calling for residents in Glendive, Montana, which has a population of about 5,000 people or so. They're urging them to avoid any ingestion of municipal water because it's shown an elevated level of volatile organic compounds, predominantly benzene. And in case you didn't know, the CDC points that benzene is clearly cancer-causing, leukemia-causing chemical that should not be ingested in any way, shape, or form. City officials are urging residents to use bottled water, which they've reportedly shipped in for public distribution. So that's one disaster happening in Montana. And, well, what Montana residents are facing right now is actually nothing new to the people of the Andean region in South America, where a rapacious appetite for fresh water by the mining industry, global agribusiness, and other extractive corporations, those same companies that will be coming into New York on Monday to negotiate TPP, threatening the water supply of millions of residents from Colombia, from Peru, Ecuador, Bolivia, Chile, and Argentina. And the good news is that there's an ongoing fight and resistance for the defense of water rights in Latin America. And that's the focus of the forthcoming edition of NACLA's Report on the Americas, NACLA, the North American Congress on Latin America, one of our community partnership partners here with WBAI. As part of this partnership, we were provided an advanced copy of the issue. Again, it's coming out probably in the next couple of weeks, which features a very special edition focusing on water in Latin America. I spoke with its guest editor, Heather Williams, yesterday about the report. Williams is a professor of politics and environmental analysis at Pomona College, and she's written on social movements, the environment, labor, and migration. She also co-founded the Suma Kuta Beautiful Lake Citizen Monitoring Initiative in the Lake Titicaca Basin of Peru and Bolivia. I first asked her to explain to us why NACLA decided to focus on water in the Andes.
For me, the Andes are a really important region to understand the global water crisis, because I would maintain that they're ground zero in the Western Hemisphere for a crisis, especially in Ecuador, Peru, Bolivia, and Chile, where dwindling supplies of water are being utilized and also being polluted at an accelerated rate. And at the same time that we see a radical reshaping of the hydroscape due to changing precipitation patterns and receding glaciers. So the populations of the Western Andes are really caught in a vice of accelerating demand and also declining ability to control the basins that are so vital to what they do.
Now, tied to that, obviously, you know, water is always a precious resource, but when could we say the kind of growth and the expansion of these intense global and national water-intensive extractive industries begin to perhaps put on more pressure on the very precious resource of water in the Andes?
I would say it starts about 15 years ago, when you see an acceleration in Latin America in general in commodity exports to Europe, the United States, and also to East Asia, which is fast industrializing and in need of a lot of metals, of hydrocarbons and metalloids, and also an increasing demand for agro-exports in the global grocery commodity chain. So if you go to Safeway these days, and it's the winter, a lot of your winter vegetables are going to be coming from the irrigated lands of the Western Andes that, without that irrigation, are about as dry as Baghdad.
I want to stick to some of the more broad issues and then get into some of the specific articles that are featured in the upcoming edition of NACLA. But first, you actually have a sidebar on it, a couple of sidebars, one focusing on the protests recently in Peru around the COP20 summit, and also in the article about glaciers. glacial retreat in the Andes. Mm-hmm. So I want you to touch on and explore a little for our listeners the connection between the issue of water, the water resources, with this global climate crisis that we're suffering through right now.
Absolutely. You know, it was really ironic to see the global climate talks in December in Lima, and I wasn't surprised to see them break down virtually break down in an agreement in the end almost not to agree, and for countries next year to bring voluntary agreements to the Paris summit, which is kind of a do or die conference in every sense of the word. But the way that water is connected to climate change in the Andes is very, very clear. So you've long had water as an object of conflict in the Western Andes, and you've had all kinds of skirmishes and a lot of political problems connected to it. Most of the people who live in the Western Andes are living on the Pacific side of the Andes, which are a massive physical system running up the western spine of the continent that rise to about 20,000 feet in height in the highest part of them. And what happens is that it's a very dry desert on the Pacific side of that, and then the other side is the Amazon drainage, at least in Ecuador and Peru. And the way that water is connected to this is that people have long been able to thrive. In fact, civilization probably goes back 15,000 years in the high Andes, in part because the Andes serve to as a rain shadow. You have water falling mostly as snow in the high Andes, and so you have a lot of the hydroscape that is glacier-fed. So 99% of the world's tropical latitude glaciers are in the Andes, and then the greatest number of those are in Bolivia and in Peru. And for a long time, people have utilized rivers that are fed by glaciers. These began to retreat in the 1970s, and they're probably anywhere from 30 to 50% gone, and they're projected to be entirely gone by about 2040 or 2050. It's a devastating retreat of the glaciers. And why does that matter? It matters in part because the water has typically gone down into mountain lakes and into aquifers, which serve as storage during a 6 to 7 month dry season. And now what you're doing is you're getting devastating floods when the glaciers are melting at very rapid rates in the warmer months. And then you're getting extended droughts and then delayed onset of precipitation for farmers in the fall. So climate change is really affecting people very directly. And then you're seeing increasing concessions to that water to agribusiness, and effective concessions to it to mining companies that use the water to some degree in their operations, but they also need a place to dump their waste. And a lot of this goes into slurry that's wet slurry, and then that is often contaminating water supplies. Mm-hmm. So that's how climate change is impacting the people in the Andes.
Right. So it's a triple quadruple whammy, not just a double whammy in terms of how this impacts local populations. I want to remind listeners that we're speaking with Heather Williams. Heather Williams is a professor of politics and environmental analysis at Pomona College and is the editor of an important section of the forthcoming edition of NACLA's report on the Americas, which focuses on water, water consumption, water rights in the Andean region. One of the articles is by Barbara Lynch, which focuses on Peru in 2009, piece of legislation, water reform legislation that took place that in many ways was promoted as a way to protect water, but it is in many ways fueled many of the conflicts that have ensued between the extractivists and the local communities. Could you elaborate on her article?
Yeah, it's a great article. It's about the Rio Santa, which is one of the biggest rivers. It's actually the biggest river that flows down the western side of the Andes. But that being so, it's not that big a river in the grand scheme of things. I don't think it would make a list of the world's 100 biggest rivers. And so there is a great deal of competition for this river. favor among, you have small farmers and tourists, but you also have huge coastal agro-export firms. You have transnational energy corporations that are capturing the river for hydropower, and you have city distribution systems in Chimbote and Trujillo and Huaraz. And so essentially what she's highlighting is the difference between what water law looks like on paper and how it's playing out on the ground. And so on paper, if you were to look at Peru's 2009 water law, it looks like a kind of a dream law. It's very expansive. It's based in principles of integrated water resource management that's long been talked about by the United Nations, that's built in the so-called Dublin principles that include the right of people to access water, and it speaks about the necessity of involving people in the management of basins. And so it sets down on paper a seemingly very orderly and democratic way for basins to be managed and to be also to for there to be basin-wide decisions on how a river is utilized and how its various hydrological functions are preserved in the, say, associated, you know, making sure, for example, that a river is continuing to feed its wetlands, that it's continuing to fill aquifers that are associated with it. But in practice, what she shows is that managing this river has been really the managing of probably some irreconcilable demands by an excess of demands given the supply of water. So in practice, basins are really characterized by anarchy, as she shows. And there's no single overriding agency that's actually collecting data, that's talking to stakeholders, that's making basin-wide decisions, that's sharing with stakeholders what the projected river deliveries are going to be. And so she's showing that, in fact, a lot of the concessions to the river are being made is backroom deals by agencies that may or may not have the legal authority to do so.
And that happens elsewhere. It's in fact, there's many parallels with another article in the issue, Rachel Conrad's piece about the Hydro Tambo hydroelectric dam in the Dulce Pamba River Basin in Ecuador. And this is a fascinating case study of how these deceptive processes of you know, giving the rights of water to extractive industries and really alienating and completely marginalizing local communities. Could you talk about that particular story?
Absolutely. This is such an important story and so ironic in so many of its aspects. Essentially some years ago, a concession was made to a company to build what is called a run-of-the-river dam. Then on paper, again, it sounds like a really good idea. It's a dam that captures the energy flow of a river without causing the flooding in the big reservoir that is often identified as the big problem with dams. It looked like it was a good, green, clean source of energy that would be a win-win for everyone. But the problem was, in order for this dam to be feasible for the private corporation that had gotten the concession for it, it was necessary to keep anyone upstream from using that water for their fields. And this was a huge problem for the people who farmed for generations in the Valley of San Jose del Tambo, and who suddenly were told by armed guards and military people who came to shut off their irrigation gates and told them, "I'm sorry, this river has been is off limits. You may not use it." And so, by decree, the government had allotted this run of all of the flow of the river to this run of the river dam that was at least partly owned by foreign corporations, and that was made feasible, ironically enough, because it was receiving money through the through a part of the Kyoto Protocol, and so this was a CDM credit, which was essentially a carbon trade whereby a polluter in the first world bought the rights to the to clean energy somewhere else in the world, and as a result did not have to reduce their carbon emissions to their cement plants or their electricity plants in the Czech Republic or in France or wherever it was clearing on the European trading system. And so here, in the name of emissions reduction and in the name of clean energy, you had this community, actually at least 80 different small villages who were then prevented from using a river for their traditional production, for their animals, for their livestock, for their orchards, for their fields.
Again, we're speaking with Heather Williams, a professor of politics and environmental analysis at Pomona College. We're talking about the forthcoming edition of NACLA's report on the Americas, which has an incredible section looking at the issue of water and water rights in the Andes. I want to get to your particular article, and I know you've spent a considerable amount of time in Peru, where President Humala has gotten a lot of public relations mileage out of some of his policies, but not necessarily in the interest of the people most affected by these extractive industries exploiting the water. Could you talk a little bit about your article and the quote-unquote informal mining ban that took place, but that in essence hasn't really been worth the paper it's written on?
Watching the news, especially the English language news, may have the impression that President Humala, or Ollanta Humala, despite some accusations that he is sacrificing the regulation of the environment for the sake of short-term growth, is in fact taking measures to end the worst kind of mining in Peru. So the government has argued that in Peru there are two kinds of mining. There's the environmentally sustainable and regulated mining, and then there's another kind of mining that's off-the-books mining that's sometimes called informal mining. A lot of it's for silver and gold. It has been responsible for the devastation of especially the Madre de Dios River, which is a beautiful Amazon tributary that is very much under threat from deforestation and widespread mercury poisoning from mining. But this form of mining that's often done by tens of thousands of small miners working in extraordinarily dangerous conditions, using crude forms of mining, sometimes just pallets or backhoes to take away the what's called the overburden or the soil on top of the ore, and using very crude means to extract the ore, and then oftentimes using a mercury amalgam, taking quicksilver mercury and mixing it with a pulverized form of the ore, and then burning it off on open pans with huge mercury releases from this. This form of mining, for each person doing it, may produce a gram or two of gold a week, and not very much money for those people. But together, it probably accounts for about 15% of Peru's gold exports, and maybe 10% of global gold supplies when you take all of the informal operations around the world. So it was in 2013 that the government announced that there would be a ban on informal mining, and the government essentially would allow small-scale mining but only under tight regulation with a licensing procedure for the people engaged in these activities, presumably with greater protections for them, labor protections, and environmental protections for the people downstream of these operations. What has, in fact, occurred is that the military raids have to seize the equipment that's involved in this will capture a great deal of press, but we don't have a lot of evidence that it has ended these practices. And it also is built on this myth that, in fact, that there is effective regulation of what's called formal mining or on-the-books mining and taxed mining. So the kind of media-friendly steps that are being taken to do this really are papering over a bigger crisis in the extractive sector, which is of the unwillingness or the lack of capacity of the government to regulate mining environmentally and also to provide any real access to justice, to legal avenues of redress for communities that are affected by both formal and informal mining. And so communities that have attempted to take companies and or groups of miners to court have found that they have no redress under the law and that the government is unwilling or unable to collect the data that would actually prove or disprove allegations that they've been harmed. Mm-hmm. So I, for example, begin this article with the story of Gila Central, which is one of hundreds of communities on the Ramis River in the highlands of the southern department of Puno in Peru, where a gold mine at the foot of the receding Ananea Glacier has resulted in the migration of 40 to 50,000 miners who have done open pit mining in an area that's probably about 24, 25 square kilometers now, and dumped most of the arsenic-rich sediment down the river, and the river turned brown, and much of the sediment then arrived on people's fields through yearly flooding and also through their small-scale irrigation systems. Mm-hmm. And people's crops would no longer grow. Much of their livestock died, and their fields are covered in this fine silt that is full of heavy metals.
Heather Williams is a professor of politics and environmental analysis at Pomona College. She's written on social movements, the environment, labor, and migration. She edited the forthcoming edition of NACLA's report on the Americas, particularly its focus on water in the Andes, and that should be coming out in the next couple of weeks or so. We'll give you more details on it. You can find more information about NACLA at their website, nacla.org. And we'll be, of course, linking to their website from the WBAI homepage at wbai.org.